Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Rather than our typical psalm study this evening, we're actually going to proceed with another message in our doctrinal study. So, Ecclesiastes chapter 3. So in our study of Bible doctrine, we have been talking about the doctrine of God, and we've been looking at God's will. And so this will be message number 11 in that series. I guess I need to give everybody a little bit of time to switch notebooks. This is message number 11 in that series, and the title is God's Will in the Bad Time. So we're going to be looking, starting here in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get, and a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away, a time to rend, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. So when was the last time that you heard someone praising God for foul, miserable weather? When was the last time you praised God for such? Well, is God the God of fair weather only? So over the last few messages, we have been gathering up a number of biblical references pertaining to God's will and what is known as His sovereign design and control of all things. So just to summarize where we are, we have seen that God has a perfect and complete will from before the foundation of the world. We've seen that His will is one. It's one will that includes everything in an ordered and a unified purpose. That we've seen that in any one event or even in a series of events that God has a purpose and even has various purposes. And it, obviously, since an event can have more than one effect and therefore accomplish different though unified purposes, we've also seen that individual events make up the all things or the everything that God works according to the counsel of His own will, and that the various purposes of God in those individual events lead up to the ultimate purpose of God, that God be glorified in everything that He wills to be. All right, so that's where we are at this point. And we want to begin in this message considering some of the common questions and maybe even objections to the biblical view of God's will that we have been looking at over the last few messages. Now, the most common question or objection at this point is typically some form of how can God will everything to be when there is sin and evil in the world. In other words, it's a lot of times stated in such a way as how could a good God or how could a loving God will for some tragedy to be? Well, again, we only have a couple of options. Either God willed for it to be, or He didn't, and it is contrary to His will. And saying that, well, God didn't will it to be, but He permitted it, sounds nice, and sometimes makes us feel a little better, But it doesn't really solve the problem. I mean, saying that God permitted it means that if He truly permitted it, then He could have stopped or prevented it, but didn't. So He had the power and the wherewithal to stop some event from taking place, but He didn't. In that sense, He permitted it. He permitted it. Now, if He could have prevented the tragedy from occurring, if He couldn't have prevented it, then He didn't actually permit it. He was powerless to stop it, whether He wants it to be or not. So that's in no way permitting it. Some may say, well, Satan caused the tragedy, and then God works to overcome it or to bring some sort of good out of it. Well, Satan may have been an agent at work in the tragedy, and oftentimes is, but God still willed for it to be, or He didn't will for it to be, regardless of the agents and actors that were involved in bringing that event to pass. If He did not will for it to be, then Satan is a creator of reality. And Satan's will supersedes God's will, at least in that event. And this would mean that God is not without an equal, as the Bible clearly says that He is. That God is not a power above all powers, as the Bible clearly shows Him to be. So ultimately, when we object to God willing everything because of the existence of this or some other bad or seemingly non-good, when we object to that, what we're doing is we are limiting God in His purpose, His power, His will, His design, His sovereign control. We're limiting God to be the God of the blue skies and sunshine. What it is that we perceive as good. Oh, in those things, God has a will. In those things, God has control. In those things, God is working all things to accomplish His purpose. All right, so we want to take up this problem. Sometimes this is referred to as the problem of evil, though we're not looking at it quite so much as in terms of the existence of God. But in order to do so, we need to review God's sovereign control of all things with an eye toward these calamities. What does the Bible say about this? So we want to begin considering wind and water and wildlife in God's control. So God unquestionably controls what we call nature, or the forces of nature in the world. Things such as weather and various weather events. And that would be the sunshine and blue skies, as well as the gray clouds, as well as the wind, as well as the rain, as well as the storms, and on and on and on we could go. So Psalm 147, verses 15 to 18 speaks of God saying, He sendeth forth His commandment upon earth. His word runneth very swiftly. He giveth snow like wool. He scattereth the hoarfrost like ashes. He casteth forth His ice like morsels. Who can stand before His cold? He sendeth out His word and melteth them. He causeth His wind to blow and the waters to flow. After that, Jesus had been awakened from the bottom of the boat by the disciples and the storm on the Sea of Galilee. And He comes to the front and He speaks, "Peace be still." And immediately the winds and the waves stop. We're told in Mark chapter 4 and verse 41, "And they feared exceedingly and said one to another, 'What manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey Him?'" Well, that's what the Bible presents to us about God. The wind and the sea and the rain and the snow and the frost and all of these forces that we sometimes call nature are under His direct control. Well, not only is it the forces of nature, such as the wind and the water, but even the animals we see are under God's control. And there's a lot of different passages actually that talk about a lot of these things. We're just sort of taking a sample. But think about Daniel being thrown into a den of lions. And he ought to have been killed. That was the expectation that he would be killed. But he wasn't. Daniel 6:22, Daniel said, "My God hath sent His angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. So Daniel testifies and says, yes, I spent the night in the den of lions, but nevertheless, God sent his angel to close their mouths, and they've not hurt me. Elijah was fed during the drought, 1 Kings chapter 17 and verse 4. God speaking to Elijah, and it shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed thee there. So even, and again, we could look at other examples, Balaam's donkey and other examples that were told about in the Bible, the great fish that was prepared to swallow Jonah and then to spit him back up. And so God's control extends over all of the creation, all of these natural forces, whether it would be the elements or whether it would be the plant and animal life, even down to the microorganisms like bacteria and viruses and things of that nature, that these are all under God's control. But this control is not limited to just the blue skies, the sunshine, and lock-jawed lions. See, that all sounds very good. Well, God has control, and we need rain to water the earth, and we need sunshine, and we even need wind. And here, look, these animals did good. They didn't hurt Daniel. They fed Elijah. That's all very good. But the Bible goes further than this. It's not only in these good cases that God exercises control, but also in the hard cases. The wind and the water also comes in the form of hurricanes and tornadoes and typhoons and tsunamis and floods. Things that bring disaster and even death. So it was a wind that knocked down the house on top of all of Job's sons and daughters and killed them. That's in Job 1:19. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And later, when Elihu was speaking wisdom to Job, he said in Job 37:9 that out of the south cometh the whirlwind. And in verse 13, he said that God causeth it to come. He goes on to say he has his purpose for doing so, but he sends it. This is Job, who lost all of his sons and daughters in one blow by a wind that knocked the house down on top of them. And of course, not long after Elihu's speech, God speaks to Job and Job repents. When Job got word of what had happened, and again, this terrible things that happened one after the other, the worst coming in the form of his children being killed. In Job chapter 1, verses 21 and 22, Job said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. Now, God expressly states that he works calamities. Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 7. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. The word for evil in that passage has the idea of calamity or of catastrophe. God expressly states that he works these calamities. Amos chapter 3 and verse 6, shall a trumpet be blown in the city and the people not be afraid? And shall there be evil or again a calamity or a catastrophe in a city? And the Lord hath not done it. In other words, that it has not come from his hand. And such catastrophes bring pain, they bring destruction, and they bring death. Well, even the animals, a part of this natural world that God has created, and we've already seen how that He is in control over them as well, and they do good, but they also do harm. God shut the mouths of lions to save Daniel, but He sent lions to kill the Assyrians. In 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 24 to 25, "And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Kuath and from Abba and from Hamath and from Sepharvaim and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them which slew some of them." So yes, on the one hand, He stopped the mouths of a lion, didn't let them hurt Daniel. But then on the other hand, sent lions to kill some of those Assyrians. So when we are thinking about the things that take place on the earth, the things that take place around us all the time, things that happen to us, to those we know and love, you know, we're not really that much concerned about exploding stars in space. We're not really so concerned about the death of a whale in the depths of the ocean. We're not even really that concerned about an avalanche in some remote part of a mountain range that affects no one. But these are all calamities just the same. I mean, these are all destructions and ruin within the creation. But what really makes for a calamity for us is when people are affected by it. Even when people are killed by such events. But the Bible leaves no question that God ultimately controls and directs all of these things in the universe that He has created. Well, that brings us to the next consideration. Not only is God in control of nature, and that's those natural forces and animals and such, not only is God in control of those things, but God is actually in control of all life. And that's really what's at the heart of thinking about calamities and God's will and how these things may work together. So as we saw in the text where we started, there's a time to be born and a time to die. So Solomon gives us actually here in Ecclesiastes 3 in verses 1 to 8, he gives us one of the most profound statements of God's sovereignty in all of the Bible here in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. It's oftentimes misread. It is oftentimes looked at as this is a saying that just says, you know, there's all these different times and seasons in life and we just have to embrace them and recognize them and go with them for what they are. It's not at all what Solomon is saying. Solomon says, "To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven." By talking about season and time and a purpose under the heaven, Solomon is referring to God's providential governance of His creation. As he speaks about in the book of Ecclesiastes, like in chapter 2, again in chapter number 10, he makes it very plain. In other words, what he's ultimately saying here is that we don't control these things. A time to be born and a time to die, we don't control that. That's not in our hands. The time to rejoice and the time to weep and all of these things that he talks about. He says there's a time appointed by who? Appointed by God. It's under heaven. There's a time appointed by God for each and every one of these things. And we're going to pass through all these various experiences in life. And these things are not of our own contrivance or of our own doing. He also says in another place in Ecclesiastes that God has set the day of adversity over against the day of prosperity. Why? That we might learn wisdom. That we are not in control of this life and this world. But God is. So God sets the times. God sets the seasons. The, and the words that are used here even indicate appointments. God appoints these times and seasons, including, as he starts in verse 2, a time to be born and a time to die. Life is in God's hands, from birth to death and all the funny business in between. God clearly states that he is in complete control of life and death in such places as Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse number 39. See now that I, even I am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. In Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 6, the Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. Paul echoing the same sentiment in there at Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17, verses 24 to 26. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. It is no accident, it is no chance that we are born when we are born, that we are born where we are born, that we die when we do, that we live where we do. These things are not accidents. And we may think, oh, well, you know, I planned this and I did that and I did the other thing. And we'll talk about some of that at another time, not tonight. So it's no accident. Our lives are in God's hands. It's no accident that I was born to the parents that I was born to at the time that I was born, that I have lived to see the things that I have seen in the time that I've been alive. That's no accident, and it surely wasn't designed by me. God is sovereignly in control from the very beginning. In Psalm 139, verses 13 to 16, for thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. In other words, the words indicate that of being knit together, almost as just the picture is of God shaping and fashioning each individual in the womb, beginning from the very beginning of their life and that conception. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. So if God has willed the time of our birth, and God has willed the time of our death, and all of those events in between, then he has necessarily willed all of the conditions and circumstances and actions that bring those various things about. So we come again to consider whether this is only limited to what we perceive as good. Is God's sovereignty over my very life and your very life, is it limited to only what we perceive to be as good? Well, just as God being the God of blue skies, is God only the God of health and happiness? Oh, there are many preachers that would be glad to tell you so. But here again, just as God wills calamity, God wills calamity even in our lives. Things like deformities and diseases and all of these various things that attend life. In Exodus chapter 4 and verses 10 and 11, God speaking to Moses. And Moses said unto the Lord, O Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant. But I am of slow speech and of a slow tongue. So Moses is indicating that he's in some way below average. Perhaps he had some sort of a speech impediment. I don't know exactly what he's indicating here, but he's indicating something that he's not like other normal men in this regard. And the Lord said unto him, Who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? In other words, God doesn't tell Moses, Moses, you're just being self-deprecating. Your mouth is fine. Your speech is fine. You're a good speaker, Moses. He didn't come along just to encourage Moses and he'd be able to speak well. No, he acknowledged it, but he said, Who's made your mouth? Who's made your mouth that way? So you're not like normal men in regard to speaking. Who's responsible for that? Moses didn't make his own mouth. God made it, and whatever was wrong with it, that's how God made it. God said, I make the dumb, I make the deaf, I make the blind, and I make the seeing. I make them all. Well, let's consider the blind for a moment. John chapter number 9. So there was a blind man in John chapter number 9. We'll start here with the first three verses. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. So here's a situation where this man was born blind. And of course, as you read the whole account, it's a pretty fairly lengthy chapter, but as you read the whole account, there were plenty of witnesses confirming the fact that this man was indeed born blind. He had grown to adulthood. He had never been able to see. What was wrong with him? I don't know, but he was blind. And the disciples asked the question, Is this blindness on this man? Is it a result of sin? Did this man sin? Did his parents sin that this has been put on him as a punishment? Now notice what they did not ask. They didn't ask if God had done it. That's not what they asked. They are rather asking, why has God done this? Why has this man been born blind? Why has he been made this way? Is it because of some sin in his parents or because of some sin in himself? Now, so they are questioning, and actually they're reflecting a very common view in that day within Judaism, something that's even taught in the Talmud of the writings later, that birth defects were the result of sin. And they were either the result of some sin in the parents, that birth defects in their child came as some sort of punishment to their parents, or that they were the result of some sin of the baby in the womb. Now, they have been fairly silent. I haven't seen much updated information on exactly how the baby sinned in the womb that resulted in the blindness. But anyway, that was just their basic idea. Well, this person's blind. This person's handicapped. This person has a deformity. This person has some sort of problem, some defect from birth. So obviously, it's some sort of punishment for sin. Well, Jesus plainly answers here that it was neither. This was not a punishment for sin. Not any sin by his parents, nor any sin in this man. Now, he's not here saying that his parents and this man are perfectly sinless. He's just simply saying that's not the reason why this man was born blind. It was not because of sin in his parents or in himself. What he does say is that it was for the purpose of God being glorified in his healing. So think about this for a moment. This man was born blind. So you have a father and a mother who are expecting a child, and no doubt expecting a child with great joy. And this child is being formed in the womb by God. And as God is forming this child and covering this child in the womb, God makes this child blind. And he's going to be born that way. And the child is born and grows even to adulthood. And by all indications and just the way that he's referred to and being of age and all those things, he's got to at least be 30, if not 40 years old by the time that this happens. So he's born blind. He's lived all of his life this way to this point. So no doubt this has been a grief to him, to his parents. It's been a burden. It's been a source of suffering and sorrow. It's been a difficulty. But then Jesus heals him and manifests that he is the light of the world. And also, in fact, states that he was born blind for that very purpose, indicating that it was God's will, that it was God's purpose, and it was God's design. So what about Satan, though? Because, as we said, and this was much earlier in the message, thinking about, isn't it just the bad things that happen? Isn't that just the working of Satan, and he's trying to oppose God, and so God will overcome it and or bring good out of it? Well, obviously, Satan only works evil. Only. He does not work good. There is no good in him. We'll probably do a message on Satan more fully a little later on. But he only works evil. And he only has malice. There's no good motivation or desire within him. So how does he fit in with the picture of God's will of everything? Because oftentimes many people think, well, he's the force of evil. He's the reason that there's darkness or that there's suffering or that these other things come about, and God's just trying to combat it, and will ultimately, he'll overcome. Well, if you go back again to the story of Job, in Job chapter 1, verses 6 to 12, and in chapter 2, verses 1 to 7, those passages make clear that Satan was the agent bringing calamity upon top of calamity on to Job. In fact, Job chapter 2, verse 7 says, "So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown." He gave Job a grievous affliction. But if we read the account of Job carefully, verses like chapter 1 and verse 12, chapter 2, verse 6, we see that these verses plainly state that Satan was only permitted to do what God allowed him to do and no more. That's all that he was permitted to do. Furthermore, Job attributed those calamities to God's hand. Job chapter 1, verses 21 to 22, and Job said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And then the author adds this, "In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly." So, in other words, there's a confirmation here that Job is speaking the truth. God gave, and God take away. Oh, well, I thought Satan was the actor and the agent, and he was. But Satan only did what God permitted him to do, and no more. Job 2 and verse 10, "But he said unto her," this is Job responding to his wife, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips." And it's clear in the rest of the book that Job's calamities were ultimately from God, and they were for God's purpose. And God's sovereignty is asserted over and over again in the book of Job. Not only this, but Scripture elsewhere affirms that God was the ultimate determiner of Job's trials. James chapter 5 and verse 11. Behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. It's easy for us to read over that and to not actually just take in what it's saying. The word for end, the Greek word telos, and it is a word that means the end point or the end goal. It's something that is aimed for. It's something at which you will be at a conclusion because you have reached it. In other words, it's speaking of God's purpose in the suffering of Job. God's control extends, obviously, then, over Satan and over all demons. Mark chapter 1 and verse 27, and they were all amazed, as after Jesus had cast out a demon, insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, what thing is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority commandeth he even the unclean spirits, and they do obey him. And they did every time. We could also say that Paul suffered in ways similar to Job when God permitted Satan to afflict him. And here's what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 7. And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. So Paul says that Satan was afflicting him. Satan was afflicting him. But why? Satan was afflicting him that he would be humbled. Now, obviously, Satan's purpose in afflicting Job or Paul or any other child of God is not their sanctification. That is not the purpose that Satan has. That is not his motivation. He is not working in order to make people more like Jesus Christ. That is not his goal, ever. But to snatch them away from God. He's trying to wreck and ruin and destroy. Peter said, he's like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Well, God's purpose was not for Paul or Job to be snatched away. God's purpose was for them to be humbled and through suffering to be more conformed to the image of Christ. So God accomplished a good purpose in a bad time through an agent that was seeking to accomplish a bad purpose. So just as God wills everything to be for His maximum glory, He wills the time of calamity to be for His glory as well. He does not permit any evil that will not be ultimately for His glory. Proverbs 16:4, the Lord hath made all things for Himself, yea, even the wicked for the day of evil. Psalm 76:10, surely the wrath of man shall praise Thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. Paul said that he learned to glory in suffering, that the power of Christ would rest on him and be magnified. So God is in control of absolutely everything. And that means that everything accomplishes his purpose for his glory. But we should not deduce from this that God is cold and hard and angry and bitter. God is good. And God is gracious. God is slow to anger. God is abounding in grace and mercy. He sent His Son into the world to suffer the greatest calamity and tragedy that will ever occur. And He did that so that we might be saved and be delivered from catastrophe forever in His presence, to the praise of the glory of His marvelous purpose.